Hello, and welcome to Stars, Cells, and God, the show where we discuss new discoveries taking place at the frontiers of science that have theological and philosophical implications, as well as new discoveries that point to the reality of God's existence. My name is Hugh Ross. I'm joined by our president, Fazrana. We'll be your guide today as we explore different topics that we'll be discussing. But before we get into these discussions, I wanted to encourage you to subscribe to our YouTube channel, Reasons to Believe YouTube channel, and click on the bell icon so that you can be informed of our new videos. Learn more at reasons.org or by following us on social media at RTB_official. Let's start with you, Fuzz. You've got a lot of really curious-looking slides that I'm interested in enjoying. So what's the discovery?
Yeah, well, it's going to be about chimpanzee behavior. But to ease us into the discussion, I think all of us who've had pets or who've interacted significantly with animals really appreciate that these creatures can be quite intelligent.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And they display an emotional richness that I don't think is oftentimes fully appreciated. You know, I remember this English bulldog that we used to have.
Archie. Archie.
Yeah. And he was, this bulldog was a lot of fun. He was just filled full of personality. But one of the things that Amy and I taught him to do is to ring a bell that was hanging on our sliding glass door if he wanted to go out into the backyard. And so sometimes he would ring it, but then he went through a stretch where he just stopped ringing the bell. And he would just sit there till we went and opened up the door. And we thought, well, maybe he didn't really learn how to use the bell. But then one day there was a cat in the backyard, and he wanted to go out there to chase the cat. And he's just wanging away at the bell, like, hurry up, get me out of here. But, you know, that's just just a fun story that just, you know, again, reminds us that, you know, animals are really, you know, much more impressive than we oftentimes may think, right? And that has actually some really important theological implications.
Let me share a story.
Okay.
Because Kathy and I were in Gibraltar before COVID, and on the rock of Gibraltar, there's all these macaque monkeys, and they're really smart, and they're very good at picking pockets. But they seem to know that a passport has really high value, and they know the difference between a cheap watch and an expensive watch or a wallet. And they will pickpocket from you, and they'll wave it in front of you, but they will not give it back to you unless you give them a high-quality treat. If you want your passport back, you really better give them a really good treat, because if you give them some cucumbers, forget it. They're not going to give you the passport back. But it's like they've been engaging humans long enough to be able to figure out. They don't know what a passport is, but they know they can get a really good treat if they bargain with that passport. So
Yeah. Well, you know, and it's not just these anecdotal stories, right? But it's also a lot of work that's being published now in the peer-reviewed literature by animal behavioralists who are really documenting with some scientific robustness, you know, animal intelligence and, again, emotional capacities. You know, animals are able to engage in problem solving, a type of technical inventiveness or creativity. Again, remarkable creatures. And as I mentioned, this has theological implications and philosophical implications. So people like our friend Nathan Lentz, who was here at Reasons to Believe this summer.
Right.
He participated in a workshop on human exceptionalism. He's an atheist and is of the view that really humans only differ in degree, not kind, from other creatures, and wrote a book called Not So Different, where he kind of summarizes this idea where he says, all the impressive human cognitive abilities evolved in ancestor species that already had an extensive palette of emotional states. In order to understand how our ancestors made the jump from animal behavior to human psychology, we must first recognize that the distance of the evolutionary jump is not as great as it seems. You know, so again, you know, how do we make sense of these kinds of insights in light of our view at Reasons to Believe that humans are made in God's image and because of that really are exceptional and stand apart. And, you know, you mentioned macaque monkeys, but, you know, there's also been a lot of work done scientifically observing chimpanzees in the wild.
Right.
And some of the things that have been discovered in the last, you know, decade or so are rather remarkable. You know, chimpanzees, for example, have been observed manufacturing spears.
Yes.
And it's like a six-step process where they take a tree branch and shape it into a spear that they will use to hunt with.
Even sharpen them.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, they also make tools to extract termites from nests. And these are not just, these are, again, modifying sticks in such a way to enhance surface area. It's pretty clever what they do. They utilize stones as a tool to open up nuts. They exploit wildfires. This is really remarkable. This was an observation made by Jill Pruitts at Iowa State, where she and her team were out in the field observing monkeys, and a wildfire broke out. And she and her team didn't know what to do. They had no idea how to move to get out of the way of the wildfire. And the chimps were literally walking right up to the wildfire and just effortlessly moving as the wildfire changed directions. And they were using this as a way to get grubs and other things out of the ground that were left behind where the fire had burned. And she was of the opinion that if they had opposable thumbs, they could probably have harvested the fire and made opportunistic use of it. So interesting stuff. Chimps have been observed occupying caves, fabricating beds where they will take tree branches, and they have the right tensile properties. So they select certain branches from certain trees with the right tensile properties. They'll incorporate vegetation that has insect repellent properties. Pretty impressive. They mourn their dead. They make use of plants for medicinal purposes. They even have been observed creating an insect paste that they will use to treat wounds.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, remarkable creatures. And again, you know, in light of these kinds of discoveries, you know, people will look at something like this evolutionary tree and they'll argue, well, because chimps are our closest living, you know, ancestor today, that clearly this capability that chimps had is really an antecedent to the remarkable behaviors that we engage in as humans that we think makes us exceptional. And so adding, you know, to all of this is a recent paper published about the use of about chimpanzees utilizing high elevations to gain information on rival groups and then making tactical decisions based on the information they gathered. And this is part of something called the Thai Chimpanzee Project. It's been going on, I believe, since 1979. And it's essentially looking at and observing and studying the chimps in the coast, in the Ivory Coast, in a place called the Thai National Forest.
Mm-hmm.
And this particular study involved observers that were studying two different groups of chimps, and these chimps had become habituated to the observers, the human observers. And this was over the span of 2013 to 2016. These researchers recorded 21,000 hours of observations.
Wow.
So, I mean, the level of work, they were in the field 10 to 12 hours a day. And what they were trying to do is, again, monitor the chimp behavior with regard to rival groups. And chimps actually have territories.
Right.
The territory size can vary from about, 5 square kilometers to about 35 square kilometers. The borders are not really well defined. And so the chimps will obviously have larger groups that occupy larger territories. And there's an advantage to expanding territories, that which makes sense, more resources, greater opportunity to grow in number, which makes that chimp group much more resilient, you know, as a tribe or as a group. And what these researchers did is they attached GPS trackers to themselves. So as they were observing the chimps, they could actually map out the territories. And then they were overlaying the territory the territories they mapped out on top of topographical maps so they could get elevation information. And then they just simply monitored these chimps as they engaged in border patrols and things like that. The chimps will break off into subgroups, apparently, and they will actually monitor the borders, so they defend their territory, and they look for opportunities to expand it as well. And when they're adjacent to rival groups, they'll actually have excursions into the rival territories and sometimes will fight with their rivals. They'll even kidnap members of the other group and kill them and things like that. So not necessarily the nicest animals, you know. But, you know, this is, again, the kind of the background for their observations. And so this is the map of the territories. For what they called the South Group and the East Group.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that chimps do is they'll have these hoot calls and they'll bang on trees. So this is a picture of a chimp banging on a tree. And that's how they kind of establish their presence, you know, in their territories. And you know, you can get information about numbers from the sound of the calls and the banging. And now in the forest, deep in the forest on the ground level, you can pick up these calls about 500 meters away. But at higher elevations, you can pick up the calls over a kilometer away. And so what they observed is that the chimps would actually climb higher elevations to listen for their rivals. They would try to get information from their rivals. Should we worry about that or just keep going?
Just keep going. You can reconnect. It probably just lost connection with your...
But, I mean, are you picking that up on the video?
No.
Okay, so we don't need to worry about it then.
But you might want to get it set up for your next set of slides.
Yeah, but I can see them on my screen.
Okay.
All right, so, yeah, and I don't know that there's any...
I will see it when I cut to the middle camera.
Okay, okay.
So, yeah.
Okay, that's what I was asking, so... There we go. All right, good. There we go.
Yep.
Okay.
Whatever.
I can't remember what I just said last.
You're talking about going up to high elevations,
What the researchers observed is that the chimps would actually climb up to higher elevations to get information on their rivals, and they noticed that they would be much more likely to climb higher elevations as they were moving from the central part of their territory towards the border regions, and less likely to do that when they were actually going from the border regions to the central area of their territory. And at these higher elevations, they couldn't really see into the dense forest, but they could hear. So on these higher elevations, they noticed that they would essentially rest. They wouldn't feed, they wouldn't move around, they would just sit still and they would rest. And so they assumed that they were listening for information about their rival groups. They also noted that when they did climb higher elevations near the center part of their territories, they weren't quiet. They didn't rest. So they thought that this was something that they were deliberately doing. And then if they could hear the chimps in their rival territory, they were much more likely to enter into the border area, the boundary area, or go into the rival territory the further away the chimps were. So they actually were able to plot out the likelihood of moving into the territory is a function of the distance of the other groups.
So they're on top of this hill or peak.
Right.
They're listening to what's going on in the rival group. When they notice the sounds are far away, they say, oh, we can go into the border territory.
Right. Right. So, you know, and so the obvious advantage there is that in exchange for expending energy to climb the higher elevations, they're getting information that they can then utilize to avoid conflict.
Right.
So even though they will fight with one another, it's much easier to simply avoid conflict altogether.
Right.
And so these chimps are gathering information and then making tactical decisions and about rival groups. And so the researchers are pointing out that this is the first time this kind of behavior has been observed in animals other than humans. Humans will use high elevation to gain information about rivals.
We do see that in birds, though, don't we?
Well, you know, it is true that other animals will exploit higher elevations to get information about food, to avoid predation, to observe predators. So there's like a sentinel behavior. But they argue that this is going one step further, where they're gathering information and then they're subsequently making tactical decisions based on that.
Like going into the border area and getting some extra food.
Right. Now, you know, one of the things that, you know, immediately comes to mind is, you know, I think they are recognizing some pretty remarkable behaviors in these chimps that's pretty sophisticated. But I think their connection between that and what humans are doing seems to me to be a bit of an anthropomorphism, right, where they are attributing human-like qualities to these animals and assuming that they're doing something that's like us or that is an antecedent to our behavior. You know, so I don't necessarily buy that. But what they're arguing is that this may actually be something that shaped human evolution, that, you know, in addition to using higher elevations as, you know, hominins moved into the open savannas to avoid predation or to get an advantage in hunting, that this may have even been a tactic that was used to be able to engage more effectively rival groups. So interesting observations that, again, these researchers are arguing is more evidence that really humans differ only in degree, not kind. You know, and again, you know, I think one, we have to be careful about anthropomorphisms when we look at this kind of data. But as remarkable as this behavior is, you know, I still think that there's a big cognitive gap between humans and chimps, right? I don't, you know, nobody's going to confuse a chimp with, you know, with a human. There's a huge cognitive gap there. And, you know, there's a growing number of anthropologists who would embrace an evolutionary perspective who are arguing that really humans are indeed different in kind, not different in degree. And one of them is Thomas Sudendorf. And I love this quote. I cite it all the time, but it's worth taking a look at here because he's, you know, essentially comparing chimps with humans, right? And his whole point is that, look, humans are doing incredibly sophisticated things. We've put people on the moon, and, you know, the chimps are about to go extinct, clinging, you know, desperately to the remaining force that they're able to live in.
And no observed technological advance.
Right. Yeah. Nothing like that. And so he's arguing here there's got to be something that's fundamentally different. Because, again, from an evolutionary perspective, humans and chimps share a common ancestor. And so chimps are essentially the tip of that evolutionary lineage from an evolutionary perspective, and we're the tip of another evolutionary lineage. And he's arguing, look, there's something fundamentally different about humans and chimps in order to explain really the different predicaments that we are in as humans versus chimpanzees. You know, and so his argument and others is that it's symbolism, right? That we have symbolic capabilities. And I'm going to skip this quote, but Sudendorf argues that this capacity for symbolism is a game changer, that while animals might be able to communicate, humans have open-ended language where we can express a near infinite number of thoughts and ideas because of our ability to combine and recombine symbols, that animals might have memory, but we have this capacity for mental time travel, right, where we can not only remember things in the past, but we can go back in the past and envision alternative scenarios that we could then live out, or we can anticipate what's coming in the future and envision alternate scenarios, you know, or, you know, he also mentions that animals have social cognition. We have theory of mind. Animals can solve problems, but we have this ability for abstract reasoning. Animals have social traditions. We have cumulative culture. Animals have empathy. We have morality. And he's arguing again for each of these pairs. One isn't just simply a predecessor to the other. There is a fundamental difference between, let's say, empathy and morality. And that difference is made possible because of our capacity for symbolism. So as the point here is that as remarkable as these creatures are, and we don't want to minimize that, to argue that this is an antecedent to what we're doing as humans is really not a correct way to think about it.
Well, especially when we see these kinds of behaviors manifested not just amongst the primates, but amongst other animals.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I mean, the argument I hear is, well, the primates are doing this. We must have gotten the similar behavior by common descent, which is why I mentioned crows.
Yeah.
I mean, crows will have a sentinel that will not feed, but just be on a high perch, look out, and be observant and give warnings. Does that mean that we're descended from crows? So the fact that we see these kinds of behaviors, not just in one species, but in multiple species, minutely different. I mean, I think we even see that with the primates. We're mentioning macaques, there's the capuchin monkeys, mm-hmm. there's the orangutans, the chimpanzees. They all manifest amazing behaviors, but they're a little bit distinct from one another.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, okay, it's not just the chimps we see this.
Right.
In fact, I just was reading one paper where they said, I think we made a mistake in identifying the chimps as the smartest of the non-human primates that are alive today. The orangutans do things chimps can't do.
Yeah.
Capuchin monkeys do things that chimps can't do. So how can we say that there's this common descent idea? And I think that's interesting that we do see something in the morphology, but if we see something different than behavior, then we have something that's out of
right.
sync
yeah.
with a common descent argument.
Yeah, I think that's really well said. You know, and on a previous episode, I think maybe you were on the episode with me, we talked about the work of Johan Lind, who's a Swedish animal behavioralist. And his argument is that a lot of the remarkable behavior we see in animals could be explained through associative learning, as opposed to what we're doing as humans, which is, again, this open-ended reasoning.
Right.
That when we solve problems, it's because of our capacity for mental time travel. Whereas when animals solve problems, it's through associative learning. And his inspiration was looking at AI systems.
Right.
AI systems, which are based on machine learning, are in effect, it's associative learning.
Right.
Right, where the rewards and the punishment or the upvotes and the downvotes, you know, as the AI system responds to things. And AI systems can learn to do some pretty remarkable things. And his point is that we might expect the same thing with associative learning in animals, and he's designed these computer simulations that are able to replicate the results of a lot of these animal intelligence studies where animals are solving problems and in even engaging in creative behavior.
Well, I find it interesting, too, that the associative learning that we see in the more cognitive animals, it's enhanced when they're bonded to human beings.
Mm.
So there's something about them having a relationship with us that makes them more effective
right.
in their associative learning.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I think that's an interesting point, you know, because not only are they bonded, but then we're involved in training them, right?
Right.
You know, we're able to give, I think, unique types of rewards and punishment to animals. But, you know, one of the things I learned with my bulldog is he was much, much more receptive to positive feedback than to any kind of punishment. So I learned quickly that, you know, I rarely would correct him. It was always through.
Has anybody ever been able to correct a bulldog?
No, you can't. I mean, it's their personality. But he responded quite well.
To rewards. Oh,
right.
Yeah.
And he would, you know, and so you could do a lot to train him or to, encourage the you know, the right behavior just through rewards.
I think that works in some of our children too.
Yeah, it does. So anyway, you know, I think it's a fascinating study that has, again, some really interesting implications. And it's unfortunate that so oftentimes these studies are marshaled in favor of trying to argue for common descent and really minimize or undermine human exceptionalism. But when we think about it a little bit more carefully, it's very clear that even though these animals are doing incredible things, still humans stand apart from these creatures.
They do, but I look at these amazing animals and say that testifies about the Creator, the mm-hmm. fact that He created this incredible variety of very high capable animals. But I think it's not only He enjoys that, but He wanted us to enjoy it.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I mean, Bible tells us He created those animals for us.
Yeah.
So I'm not at all surprised that they manifest these amazing behaviors.
Yeah.
I mean, it makes our pets much more enjoyable, right?
Yeah.
And moreover, it makes our agriculture easier that we can use these animals mm-hmm. to do things for us.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Well, that's great, Buzz.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I've got something that's in a totally different discipline, and it's a research study that just got published. In fact, it's not. It's still just available as an e-print, but it got peer-reviewed, and so it was basically put up ahead of print at Nature Astronomy, and it's a new test of Big Bang creation models. And you know, what's amazing is that as exhaustively as the Big Bang has been tested, and how wonderfully it's passed all the tests, you still got people doubting the Big Bang. And so, but, you know, as I read the paper and saying, well, I've been around long enough to realize why they're doubting the Big Bang, the philosophical and theological implications are quite potent. I mean, when the Big Bang was first proposed, you had leading astronomers and physicists around the world saying, we can't have this. It really looks like what the Bible's teaching about the beginning of the universe mm-hmm. and how God is designing the universe. So there's a lot of pushback against the Big Bang. That pushback continues to this day in spite of the overwhelming tests that have been applied to the Big Bang, which is why astronomers are still committed. Is there another way we haven't thought of testing the Big Bang? Because you've got atheists who don't like Big Bang. You've got young Earth creationists who don't like the Big Bang for opposite reasons. Atheists don't like it because it makes the universe too young. Young Earth creationists don't like it because it makes the universe too old. But, you know, as I've noted, even before I became a Christian, the Bible says some explicit things about the origin and the history of the universe, mm-hmm. things that are very much the fundamental features of Big Bang cosmology. And so I think these early astronomers were correct. Big Bang sure looks a lot like what the Bible teaches us about the universe.
So what are some of the things that the Bible explicitly says about the universe that resonate with the Big Bang?
Well, the beginning, for one.
That's yes,
the
right.
most obvious one. Yeah. The universe has a beginning. And before Big Bang cosmology was proposed in the early part of the 20th century, astronomers were saying the universe is eternal. So Big Bang was basically challenging mm-hmm. the idea of an eternal universe, that it has a finite age, it has a beginning. And the Bible also tells us that the beginning of the universe is not just the beginning of matter and energy, but the beginning of space and time. And so one of the developments of Big Bang cosmology are the space-time theorems, which basically say if we live in a Big Bang universe with gravity, with quantum mechanics and general relativity, even space and time have a beginning. And then the fact that the laws of physics don't change. I mean, that's something that's a crucial platform of Big Bang cosmology. Mm-hmm. Unchanging laws of physics, where one of those laws is a pervasive law of decay. Mm-hmm. The Bible tells us that decay is pervasive. Mm-hmm. Moreover, it's extensive. It's a high-level decay, mm-hmm. not a low-level decay. And that's what's in Big Bang cosmology. Very high entropy. So we got the universe with a high-level decay. The universe is expanding. You've got 11 passages in the Bible that mm-hmm. talk about God stretching out the heavens. And, you know, this is a core feature. A universe that gets colder and colder as it gets older and older. So there's a lot more that the Big Bang says, but these are things that actually were pre-stated mm-hmm. mm-hmm. in the Bible thousands of years ago. And if people are interested, I got an article on the internet at reasons.org written this year where I basically talk about what the Bible says about the Big Bang and the debate that theologians have had about how much or how little it says about the Big Bang. So people get to see the whole spectrum of debate. So it's up there at reasons.org. They can find it easily. But what I'm going to talk about is this paper where they said, we found a way to test the Big Bang that no one has ever applied before. And it's basically looking at galaxies in the local universe. And the reason why they focus on the local universe, when you're not, when you're looking just tens of millions of light years away or 50 million light years away, we can actually observe these galaxies and determine their morphology in great detail.
Okay.
I mean, everybody's excited about the James Webb, but it's looking at galaxies 12 and 13 billion light years away where you really can't discern much about the details of the galaxy. It's very different when we're looking, say, in our local super galaxy cluster. But what was in the literature decades ago is that in a Big Bang universe, you're going to have roughly the same spatial distribution for galaxies that are of the same mass. And so they kind of jumped on this. Said, well, number one, the galaxies that are easiest to observe in terms of their morphology their structure are the big galaxies. And so they said, hey, what previous researchers claimed is that big spiral galaxies will have the same spatial distribution as big elliptical galaxies. Now, I got some slides here. Let me see if I can get this back here. So give me a minute as I go into this feature here. Here we go. I'm going to actually show you what a big spiral galaxy looks like. Here we go. This is the Andromeda Galaxy. It's the closest big spiral galaxy to our own galaxy. And so it comes in at about a trillion times the mass of our star, the Sun. So it's definitely a big spiral galaxy. And now you can see that the stars are spread out along a disk. Most of the stars are along this disk. Moreover, what happened here? So let me see if I can get this back. Looks like I lost it. So, and I really do want people to see this. So let me do this again. Okay, here we are, back with the Andromeda Galaxy. And you can see how the stars are distributed along a disk. You can also see how the stars are spread out in the sense that they're oriented along these large spiral arms.
Right.
The extent of this is about 150,000 light years from one end to the other, so it's really spread out. And then I want to move to what we call an elliptical galaxy. Let me move down here. Okay. This is what's called a giant elliptical galaxy. And this galaxy is actually considerably more massive than the Andromeda Galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
It's several trillion times the mass of our star, the Sun. And you notice is the stars are all jammed tightly together.
Mm.
And the size of this, in terms of its spatial dance, it's actually smaller than the disk of the Andromeda Galaxy.
Okay.
But way more stars and much more mass. And so, and then has a shape that's either spheroidal or ellipsoidal in shape.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have large galaxies in these two categories. They're either spheroidal, ellipsoidal, or they're disk galaxies.
So like with a spiral galaxy, is most of the mass in a plane?
It's in a plane.
Whereas
right.
in an elliptical or spheroidal galaxy,
it's kind of like in a ball.
Okay, interesting.
And the ball is much more compact. So you got the stars jammed tightly together in an ellipsoidal galaxy, whereas a disk galaxy, the stars tend to be spread out along the disk. That's the main difference.
So that would explain why, in part, why you need to have spiral galaxies to have a life support planet is because of that density of stars?
Yeah. If you got a huge density of stars, that means number one, you get exposed to radiation from the big stars that are nearby, and you got the stars so close together, they gravitationally jostle. the planets that are orbiting those stars. That's why, you know, life is not conceivable in a globular cluster. Mm. What we see in our own spiral galaxy, there's 152 of these globular clusters where you got this 100,000 to a million stars jammed tightly together. You know, we happen to be along the disk far away from any of those globular clusters. Mm. But, you know, what the study was basically saying, okay, is it really true that Big Bang cosmology predicts that you get the same spatial distribution of spiral galaxies that you do with ellipsoidal or spheroidal galaxies? And so this is a group of European astronomers, and they used a Finnish computer simulation called Sibelius. And everybody knows that Sibelius is a famous Finnish composer. And so this is called the Sibelius Dark Computer Simulation. And so they used this computer simulation to look at Big Bang cosmology in the context of what would happen as the universe expands in the context of the local universe. And basically, they looked at the entirety of what's called the Lanikaia Supergalaxy Cluster. And I think I've got a little, yeah, here we go. This shows you, and this is a two-dimensional map. It looks different in three dimensions. But basically, you see that and a supercluster is a cluster of clusters of galaxies. And the case of the one that we live in, you've got really dense clusters of galaxies, big ones like the Virgo cluster and the Centaurus cluster that you see off to the right. You've got the Fornax cluster to the lower left, the Hydra cluster to the lower right. Those are the biggest and densest of the clusters. And what's not obvious in this particular map is that these really big, dense clusters of galaxies tend to form a plane. So just like our Milky Way galaxy is a disk-like structure, the super galaxy cluster we live in also has, not to the same degree, but you do see this concentration of these really big clusters of galaxies along what's called the supergalactic plane. And so in running the simulation, what they discovered was something surprising, namely that Big Bang cosmology predicts that you're going to get the large elliptical galaxies predominantly concentrated along the supergalactic plane, and you're going to get the spiral galaxies in isolated parts. So once you get above the plane where there's not a lot of other big galaxies and galaxy clusters around, you've got a higher probability of getting the disk galaxies. So they're basically saying the previous assumption that the spatial distribution would be the same is not correct. You're going to get a higher density of elliptical galaxies in the supergalactic plane and a higher density of spiral galaxies in the isolated parts of the supergalaxy cluster. Then they conclude their paper by saying, well, this has some relatively obvious physics implications, is that where you've got a high density of matter, what's going to be happening, you're going to get these big galaxies forming. And if they are spiral galaxies, you're going to get merger events. Mm. We've already seen when you get, say, two big spiral galaxies merging together, frequently they collapse into a spheroidal galaxy. Mm. The galaxy shrinks, and you get all the stars moving in towards the center. So they said, on that basis alone, we would expect to get a fairly high density of giant elliptical galaxies. Then these large elliptical galaxies, they will merge and become giant elliptical galaxies. Mm. That's not going to happen if you're in a less dense region of the supergalaxy cluster. The probability of the merger events is significantly lower. Mm-hmm. And that's also a place where a disk galaxy can preserve its disk structure. Mm. As long as it's able to feed on small dwarf galaxies, it can sustain its disk structure. So it basically says where we see the disk galaxies and where we don't see them actually makes sense from a Big Bang perspective. Mm-hmm. But what they really concluded is there's Sibelius dark computer simulation of what you would predict from a Big Bang creation model perspective perfectly matches the observations of the local universe. So they conclude their paper saying the Big Bang has passed yet another test. Mm. So we come up with a brand new test no one's ever figured out, But just like all the other tests, the Big Bang passed it with flying colors.
Right.
Which means, from a biblical perspective, this is good news. The Bible is the only holy book that even mentioned any of the features of Big Bang cosmology. So it's basically evidence that of all the world's holy books, the Bible got the cosmology right and predicted it in advance of what astronomers discovered.
Yeah, that's, you know, continues to amaze me, you know, even all these years later, is the scientific prescience that you see in Scripture.
Right.
You know, that, and that, you know, I was just working on a blog article about, you know, mass extinctions and mass originations in life's history, more in the context of people complain that God must not be a great designer because of all the extinction events, you know, in life's history. But, you know, I finished up the article by talking about Psalm 104, you know, in verses 27 through 30.
Right.
You know, and there's a bit of a debate among theologians as to whether that cycle of life and death and rebirth is referring to just, you know, daily occurrences in ecosystems, or is it actually, you know, referring to something like the history of life on Earth, where it's making reference to mass extinctions and mass originations. And the, you know, the argument for it referring to, again, mass extinctions is a is an interesting and a sound argument. But the point I'm trying to fumble around to make is that it's not a big leap to say this is actually talking about mass extinctions and mass originations.
Well, it isn't fuzz when you read the rest of Psalm 104,
right?
Because the rest of Psalm 104 is speaking about properties of life that are not obvious to any human observer.
Right.
What's obvious to all human observers is plants and animals die and reproduce. So I look at those last few verses of Psalm 104 and saying, it's talking about more than that, because look at the rest of Psalm 104.
Right. Well, and there's a very clear connection to Genesis 1 with the word ruach, which is the Spirit of God, and the idea of bara being used, which means to originate something new.
Right.
So it's clearly, you know, seemingly to have a deeper meaning than just what's happening on a daily occurrence in ecosystems.
It's not just reproduce, it's recreate.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's, again, it's remarkable because, you know, there's just absolutely no way that David, presumably who's the author of Psalm 104, or the people that are receiving that psalm would have any concept of mass extinctions and mass originations. Yet what's being described there seems to be a pointer, a very clear pointer, to something in Earth's history that we've only recently have uncovered. So there's this almost prophetic nature to the creation accounts in Scripture.
Well, I kind of look at Psalm 104 as God packing our planet with as much life as possible, as diverse as possible, and as broadly as possible. I mean, the language of Psalm 104 really brings that out. But that would imply that God is also wanting to pack our planet with life for as long as possible. For that to be possible, you need mass extinction events and you need mass speciation events. Otherwise, you've got a narrow window in which life can exist on Earth. And we humans are the beneficiaries of God packing the planet with as much life as possible, as diverse as possible, as long as possible, because that provides us with all the biodeposit resources we need to launch civilization and use that civilization to take the good news of salvation to all the people and groups of the world. So I kind of look at Psalm 104 as having a redemptive message.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. But again, you know, it's just amazing how when you spend a little bit of time working through these creation passages and thinking about them carefully in light of the original language, how often they seem to be pointing to something beyond what the original author would have understood.
Well, you get that in 1 Peter, that these Old Testament prophets were being inspired to write Scripture that they themselves longed to understand, but recognized this was for a future generation.
Yeah.
So it's like they knew they were being inspired in some amazing way.
Yeah.
So, yeah, remarkable. Okay, well, thank you, Fuzz. Hey, thank you, too, for joining us today on Stars, Cells, and God. Join the discussion in the comments below. Remember to like this video and to subscribe for more content. New episodes of Stars, Cells, and God release each Wednesday and are available here on YouTube and on your favorite podcast app. Be sure to share this video with a friend, and remember, the more we learn about science, the more we learn about the record of nature, God's book of nature, the more reasons we have to believe in the inspiration and inerrancy of God's book of Scripture and in Jesus Christ, his Creator, Lord, and Savior.